So, but 2 years ago, you were on and we talked about your book that actually just released. But and we're going to talk about that for sure. But one other thing we're going to talk about is you won an Emmy for a special about Alcatraz, and the name escapes me. Is it Hidden Island?
Lonely Island, Hidden Alcatraz.
Lonely Island, Hidden Alcatraz. And in 1969, Native Americans, which of course back then the papers called them Indians, occupied Alcatraz. And I find that story fascinating. So I'm going to ask you a little bit about that too. But I want to go back to your book, because 2 years ago when you were on this podcast, you were talking about The Accidental Prophet. And when you were on, you said you were going to have a book coming up at the end of that year. That was 2 years ago. And you said you were calling it Inherit the Lightning, but you weren't quite sure whether you were going to keep that name or not. So it's been a little more than 2 years, but the book has finally arrived. And we're going to have a drum roll, and you're going to say what name you finally chose for the novel.
Inherit the Lightning.
So you went with Inherit the Lightning.
I did.
Is there a particular reason why you did so?
I just thought it worked perfectly for the story. The story's about an inheritance, and the lightning has a double meaning because the name of a location in the book is called the Lightning. It was called that by the... I had the Tuscarora Indians name it Lightning Mountain, and you find out why in the book, why they chose that name, because nobody's really sure. But so it has a double meaning. It's the lightning of a spirit, a certain spirit, a confidence, and then the lightning, the hill.
Okay, well, Bud is going to tell us a little bit more about that and my fascination of this Native American occupation of Alcatraz coming up right after this.
It's time to put on your sleuthing cap, feel nail-biting dread, and face heart-racing fear. This is Queer Writers of Crime, where you'll get book recommendations and hear interviews with LGBTQ authors of mystery, suspense, and thriller novels. Here's your host, Brad Shree.
The person I've been speaking with is Bud Gundy. He is an executive producer and on-air host of KQED, which is the PBS and NPR stations in Northern California. He is also a Lambda Award nominee and is the recipient of 2 Emmys. Congratulations on those.
Thank you.
And let me change that. I hate it when people say congratulations because you did not win a prize. You earned them. So great job.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that.
I always try very hard not to say congratulations.
Okay.
So we're definitely going to talk about the book, but the reason I want to bring up this Alcatraz thing is I love San Francisco. I used to live about 80 miles from there, and I was there every day because my partner at the time worked in the city, and I picked him up to and from BART, and we spent a lot of time in the city. I fell in love with it. What I didn't fall in love with was Fisherman's Wharf.
Mm-hmm.
It's, to put it lightly, touristy.
Yes.
Very touristy.
It's very artificial.
Yes. And, you know, it's like I tell people the Grand Canyon. If you go to Arizona, you got to go to Grand Canyon just to say you've been there. Same thing with San Francisco. If you go there, go to Fisherman's Wharf just to say you've been there. But I wouldn't suggest staying that long. But one good thing about Fisherman's Wharf is that is where you catch the boats to go to Alcatraz. And I wasn't that interested in going to see Alcatraz. I mean, granted, it was a famous high-security prison, but I thought I was going to see trinkets and, you know, it was going to be a tourist trap. And I was actually pleasantly surprised that that was not the case. I found it fascinating. But I want to go a little more into that since you did the documentary about it.
Mm-hmm.
But one thing I was really interested in, at first I was kind of offended, and that was all the graffiti and the scorched buildings. And then I learned what the story behind what those were, and I'm glad they were there. It was because Native Americans took over and occupied Alcatraz starting in 1969, and I think very few people in this country ever knew this happened. Tell us about it, what you know about it. I know that's not what your show is about, but I'd like to hear what you do know about it.
Well, of course, the Indian occupation was a major part of the doc because that's a major part of Alcatraz history. But it's It has to do with a protest by Richard Oakes. I think that was the name of the leader. And they were protesting the breaking of the treaties with the various tribes, not just on Alcatraz, but around the country. And there was, I believe correctly, there was, there was something in the treaty with the Native Americans that said that if it wasn't being used, that they could have it. And Alcatraz was just an abandoned prison, but a very high-profile abandoned prison in the center of San Francisco Bay. And so they, a group of Native Americans went out there and they held the land. They stayed on the island for a couple of years. It didn't end well, unfortunately. I know Richard Oakes, I believe one of his daughters actually died because they were living in the ruins of the buildings where the families of the prison guards had lived when it was a federal prison. And they were pretty run down. You went to Alcatraz, right, Brad? You see how those buildings are just dissolving into the air. And that's kind of, it was a little better back then, of course, but it was still abandoned property, basically. And it was pretty dangerous, but it really galvanized Native Americans. It really captured the attention of the American public. I believe that Richard Nixon even, he was very sympathetic to the Native Americans, too. He was mm-hmm. president at the time. But and then, it, like I said, it didn't end well, but it did make its point. And that's what you saw there with all the graffiti. And that graffiti, by the way, is very, very well protected. They don't want that graffiti. They want to maintain it because it is such an important part of the island. So,
and now that you reminded me, I do remember reading the treaty, as far as I can understand, treaties can go. And to me, it was pretty clear as day
right.
that it should have been handed over.
Exactly.
There was no questions asked. And
right.
for those that don't know, it's now a national parkland, and that's what I presume it will remain. And what interested you about the island that made you want to do the documentary?
Well, I mean, to be quite honest, I was working at KQED and we wanted to do a documentary about it. And I was asked if I wanted to do it, and I said, yeah, of course I do. And it was a really amazing experience. We got to go into all the areas where the public can't go because it's just basically too dangerous. Mm-hmm. But we went, it's a ranger guided tour. So the rangers take you around the island in the dock, the ones who are remaining there. This was some 20 years ago. A lot of them have retired, but it was a very revealing because that location, even if it's beautiful weather in San Francisco, you're out in the middle of the bay. It's not that far. Of course, you can see right to it. But that wind coming, it's like straight from the Golden Gate, and the wind is flying through, and those seagulls and the flies, it's really a pretty brutal environment. And I know that the prisoners said that they could hear, there was a, I believe it's still there, like a sort of a fancy yacht club. And they could hear on New Year's Eve the people at the fancy yacht club having a party, and they were sitting in their cells on this freezing cold island with the gulls and the flies. And so, yeah, it's a really fascinating place. It's very spooky in a lot of ways, but definitely, as you mentioned, it's definitely worth going to see.
I think it was, in fact, I'm almost certain it was Jack London who said, and I am paraphrasing, "The coldest day I've ever felt was a summer day in San Francisco."
It was the coldest winter I ever had was a summer in San Francisco.
Okay. Well, I was close, but yeah.
And I think there's some question about whether he actually said that or not.
But. Well, yeah. You know, it's like all the things are attributed to Mark Twain.
Right.
Who knows? But it's still a pretty good quote because it's damn true.
It is.
And I'll tell you what fascinated me about going to the prison. For those of you out there who haven't been to prison, I hope that's most of you, television makes things look bigger because they got to get the cameras in there. But when you go in that prison, those cells are tiny.
Tiny. Tiny.
Like
tiny.
Really tiny. And yeah. The whole space itself that they live in was very small. It was a rather dreary place to live.
Absolutely it was. And they will all, I don't know what the new guards are like there. I knew all the old guards there, or the, you know, the Rangers rather. And they hate that movie Birdman of Alcatraz because they say it is so false. That guy was a sociopath. He was a horrible human being. And the movie made him out to be this very charming, lovely person. But anyway.
Well, nobody wants to see a psychopath taking care of birds.
Exactly, right?
Actually, that might not be a bad movie. It would just be a totally different story.
It would be, yes.
So, somebody should rewrite it.
Yeah. Tell the true story anyway.
You can get more information about episodes, plus scoops on book releases and promotions by LGBTQ crime authors each and every week. Simply head over to queerwritersofcrime.com and sign up for the newsletter. Brad made it easy and put the link right here in the show notes. Need a little nudge? Click it now and you'll also get a free ebook by one of a select group of outstanding authors. That makes not subscribing just plain silly. It's all yours at queerwritersofcrime.com.
All right, so let's get right back to what we are talking about, which is Inherit the Lightning, mm-hmm. which, as I said, the book has been out. This show airs on May 10th, which is the day it becomes available on Amazon. So it is available. You can go to the publisher and buy it. You can go to Amazon, publish it, and buy it. I just think Bud wants you to buy this book. I highly recommend it as well. Why, when you said it was going to take, and I'm not one to question because I told my readers a book was coming out 2 years ago and they're still hounding me about it, but you said in 2020 it was going to be out by the end of the year. What took so long?
Well, it was a huge, unwieldy story, and I had to figure out a number of different elements, and I was trying various ways of presenting those, like the inheritance issue. I was trying to follow legal advice that I got from lawyers about how you would structure it and all. And it was like very complex. And so I decided eventually that that wasn't working. So I took that out and I replaced it with, I think, a more interesting plot twist that reveals the character of Cooper Tiller, who's the great grandfather. And it just in a number of other ways, I could go on and on and on about how big this story was and how it took a lot of time to carefully shave and edit and shape the story. So, and I just didn't want to like put it out there before I had any confidence in it, you know?
Well, I think a lot of times when you start doing research, you find either it's going to take you down a very long road mm-hmm. to fully understand it, or it could just be boring, you know, like yeah. to make people understand the story, you're going to have to somehow make this really boring legal crap interesting.
Right. Or at least not so that you have to spend so much time on it to explain it to the reader, right? So you just have to simplify it. And that's what took me a while to get to for some of it. So, yeah.
Do you ever read James Michener?
Oh, my God. I haven't read Michener in years.
Now, I love James Michener. But for those that aren't familiar, almost every one of his books begins with the formation of the earth.
Right.
Because whatever, one book takes place in Colorado and how the settling of the West. Another one, my favorite, is takes place settling Chesapeake Bay, another Alaska, and so on and so on. So he starts with the formation of the earth and then how that particular area formed. And then he gets into the native people that lived there, which a lot of that's conjecture. And I used to try and read his novels, and I'm like, how can anybody read this? And then I learned, skip all that and go right to where the story begins. And his stories are great. So if you've tried to read a Michener novel and you couldn't do it, skip ahead to where the story really begins, and you may find it's a pretty fascinating story.
Yeah, and I remember one of his books. He started with where the dinosaurs who were living at that particular location, but. But yeah, it was, yeah, you're right. He did that a lot.
And I actually think the dinosaurs was Centennial, which is the one that took
Centennial.
Place in Colorado. Yeah,
yes.
They actually made a made-for-TV movie of that book, which wasn't bad. It was pretty good. Unlike Hawaii, which was a very good book, but they turned it into a musical and
oh my God.
It may have been a fine musical, but other than the name and the fact that it was based on his book, there's no connection whatsoever between the two.
Yeah. I remember when Hawaii was on TV. Yeah.
There was that tiki, tiki, tiki. Anyway, it was a song that drove me insane. Now, when...
I think you're getting South Pacific mixed up with Hawaii.
Am I?
Yes, because Hawaii had a very... I remember the ending of that. It was very grim. It was all the native people, the indigenous inhabitants, I guess we would want to say. But yeah, it was pretty sad ending. It wasn't a happy musical. I think you're confusing, because that... You're thinking happy, 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 happy talk. That's from...
Yes.
That's South Pacific.
Okay.
don't put me singing on the air.
And as you were talking, I pulled it up. South Pacific was based on a Rodgers and Hammerstein Broadway play. So
yes,
excuse me. Though I will say Hawaii was not all that hot either. So excuse me for confusing the two. And thank you for setting me straight. Now I want to go back and watch Hawaii and see if it's as bad as I recall.
I'm interested to go back and watch Centennial now, because I'm not sure if I even watched it when it came out, but I remember trying to read that book. But yeah, I tried was the key word there.
Yeah, it's pretty good. It's pretty good.
Is it? Okay.
I would say the miniseries is good, but like I always say, don't compare the movie with TV. They're different mediums.
Yeah.
Just absolutely. Enjoy each on their own.
Yeah.
This whole, I've always said, I don't play the book is better than the movie game, because you can't compare. You can't take a 1,000 page book and make it into a 2-hour movie and have it be the same.
Exactly.
Two different mediums.
Yeah.
Now, when we talked about the story before, Coop, who was the great grandfather. He had the inheritance, and the story spans about 140 years. Mm-hmm. And when we first talked, Coop was going to be a very small, almost a throwaway character, just to say he has an inheritance, and that was about it. That changed, and he became a much bigger part of the story. How did that come about?
Well, so Coop was just actually never going to be part of the story at all. He was just going to be an old man in on the photos on the mantle. And but the house that Coop commissioned back in 1920, I described it, and a friend of mine read that description and said, I just need to know more about this house. And so I tried a variety of ways to talk about the house and tell the story of the house, and all of them were horrible and contrived. And my friend sent me that story. I think it was by, Virginia Woolf, maybe, about the ghosts wandering through the house. But Virginia Woolf had already done it, right? So I couldn't do it. And I tried it from a number of different ways. And I finally thought, I just need to know more about Cooper, who had this house built. And I started writing his story. I always thought, he owned a coal mine, and that's where the fortune came from. And this sort of hidden fortune that the modern family, they kind of wondered where it went. Like, was it all spent? Anyway, Cooper had the house built, and I realized I had to know his story in order to talk about the house. And the more I started putting together the story of Cooper Tiller, the more interesting he became. And then the more I started studying that period, he was born in 1880. I'd always expected him to be the owner of a coal mine, but I decided that he was going to be born really poor. And so how does a poor farm boy end up owning a coal mine? And how does he know how to make that coal mine profitable, which is a very complicated story, but again, and very fascinating to me anyway. And so when I started putting his character sketch together, he just became so interesting. And I knew he had to be a major part of the book.
Was he ruthless?
Initially, I had planned him to be just sort of, like this gruff, stereotypical, very wealthy businessman from the turn of the 20th century. But that was just boring, Mm-hmm. It was just such a stereotype. And I wanted him to be a lot a lot more interesting as a character. And then as I did that, I saw ways I could make him more interesting and more interesting and more interesting. And so, no, I don't think he's ruthless. I think he's a very good person. He has his flaws for sure, but he's not ruthless.
And I'll tell you, the ruthlessness is a stereotype. It's actually for a good reason. I really love to study U.S. history from basically 1800 to 1900 because it's just amazing. I mean, we think there have been amazing changes since the 1900s to today, and there were. But that was a really interesting time period for the country just because it was such a new country and was really on the precipice of collapsing a lot. And one thing I found interesting are people like farm boys who became multimillionaires one way or another. And they were all pretty not nice people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The Vanderbilts were not the sweetest of people. And there's all, the railroad barons. I could go on and on.
Right.
I'm sure there were some great folks. Even Andrew Carnegie, who was nice enough to build a library in every town across the country, wasn't such a nice guy.
Mm-hmm.
I guess later he decided to give some people some books. But, I agree with you. It probably wasn't a good idea because it is a stereotype. But as I say many times, stereotypes do exist for a reason at times.
Exactly. Yeah, I'm aware of that too. But I was too fond of him to make him just that kind of a character. So,
well, let's go beyond the blurb. And aside from what you were going to read in online about this story, give us as much beyond that as you can, obviously without telling us the whole damn thing.
Right. So, it's about Darcy. Darcy is the great-grandson in the modern day, and Darcy's grandmother has just died. And her death, it turns out, released the estate, the inheritance. And so Darcy and his sisters discover that they are about to inherit this immense fortune that Cooper Tiller left. And he structured his will in such a way, as I said, and there's a reason for that too. And so, but there's somebody else in New York City saying, no, actually I own this estate. And so who is this person? How do they relate to the family? Like what? They've been waiting for this money their whole lives. They just kind of assumed it was gone. Like maybe it wasn't as much money as they expected and it had been spent. But they, Coop sets out, or Darcy rather, sets out to find this man. And he doesn't follow the clues necessarily to find out about his great grandfather's life, but it leads him to people who can tell him about his great grandfather. And he does make some discoveries of his own, but Darcy never knew anything about Cooper. He just was the old man in pictures. And he's amazed by the story that he learns about his great-grandfather and the reality of his life. And that, because Darcy and Coop are very similar, although neither, Cooper died, a good 20, 30 years before Darcy was born, and Darcy's not aware of his similarities to his great-grandfather. But I had a lot of fun writing them separately and then tying them together in these really interesting ways. So, for example, one thing, Darcy has a very instant connection with animals. Well, he doesn't know that, but he inherited that from Coop. So, it's just like fun things like that, but also more important. They're both very confident of their ability to conquer skills, but they both have very little faith in their emotional inner life, and they have a very hard time with relationships and love. So,
well, part of the story with Darcy learning things about Coop as the story goes along, the story is nonlinear.
Correct. Yeah.
Which sometimes is difficult for me, but when it's done well, such as the way you do, I really enjoy it. And best I can do, I think of movies, there's two movies I like. Pulp Fiction is one of my all-time favorites. And then there's one, I think I'm one of the few people that like it. It's a book called Go, or a movie called Go, which really kind of was a ripoff of Pulp Fiction, but I still like it. And they are nonlinear, but I like the way they did it. But did you plan on it being that way, or did, again, just as Coop developed, happen?
It just happened. But when you say nonlinear, it's true that we go back and forth in time and there's a little bit of time shifting within the two parallel stories themselves. But I think you can follow the progression of each of the characters fairly easily. But I didn't want to do this again, Brad. I'm constantly doing this with my characters, older characters, younger characters, parallel stories. And I never set out to do that. In fact, but I'm aware now that this is my preferred style of writing. And I intentionally set out to not write this story this way, but I could not just leave Coop. I had to write about him. So,
and that's really interesting because the last time that you were on this show, we talked about the fact that you enjoy writing intergenerational stories.
Yeah.
And while this is a case where Darcy and Coop didn't know each other, it was still very much an intergenerational story. And are you thinking that it sounds almost like you just said, you're kind of saying that's the path you're going to take?
Well,
maybe not all the time, but.
Yeah, I mean, I enjoy doing it because I love weaving these generations together. And I think these things that happened in the past have an influence on us that we're not even aware of most of the time. And I find it really, I've discovered some things in my own life about my own grandmother and the way my dad acted. My dad had a very big terror of his children being in water. And then I found out, my dad died probably 2008. And I found out just a couple of years ago that my grandmother, his mother, her older brother had drowned in like 1907 or something. And so I think, oh my God, like that's where my dad got the terror of water. He got it from his mom, whose brother drowned. So, you know, it's just like, I love exploring those kinds of connections. So, but I'm really going to try and not do it for this next one. In fact, I really don't see how I could actually, but.
You're going to have your husband hold your hands when you start to go that route.
Yes.
So are you kind of big on ancestry?
Well, I mean, I wouldn't say I'm big on it. No, I'm just fascinated by the past and I'm fascinated by the way the past influences us. Yeah. I don't know what you mean specifically by ancestry. So, I mean, like, do I study my own?
Yes.
I would say no. I know that people in my family have, and there are some interesting question marks there. We're not really sure who my grandfather was on my mom's side, and there's some reasons for that. And the story my mom told me all her life until she was like in her 90s and finally revealed the truth was not the truth. And so, but I haven't studied that, no.
Well, it is amazing some of the things that come up. My husband, Maurice, is very interested in ancestral history. And his is very difficult because his family's Creole. So you had that era where the French elite in New Orleans may have had a black wife per se, but she was not allowed to be part of society. And then once he married, she's kind of tossed aside. So that all history is kind of a hard, and plus it was a very poor area. So that history is kind of hard to dig up. But in the process, he's dug up a lot of my history, and like he'll put one of my ancestors in there and then just explode, boom. Oh, there's this tie-in with all these other ancestors. He's absolutely fascinated by my family's past. I'm like, oh, okay. but there are interesting things. Like I found out my grandmother was not my grandmother and my aunt and uncle were not my aunt and uncle. Life is very interesting.
Right.
And so that has gotten me a little more interested than I would have been. But,
Yeah. That discovery about my grandfather was pretty amazing because my mom had always told us that he died right before she was born. But it turns out and nobody's quite sure who he was and when he died or anything. So, yeah.
Well, is there more you can tell us about Darcy?
Yeah, well, Darcy is an interesting character. He's one of these guys who moved to San Francisco when he's young and because he's very interested in the idea of living in a city with a lot of gay men because it's a place for him to go party and meet guys and have a lot of sex. But guys like that can burn out. I mean, I'm not saying that they don't have a good life, you know, for the party years. And maybe some of them make it into something more substantial later in life. But they can wake up one day. I've seen this happen several times here in San Francisco, where a guy wakes up and it's like, oh, shit, you know, he's a lot closer to 40 than he is to 20. He's a lot closer to 50 even than he is. And all he's been doing this whole time is partying. He's got no money. He's, you know, he's got a dead end job, and he panics, and then he gets out of town. And I've seen that happen several times to some of my friends. And so I think he has that kind of an interesting background. I had a lot in there about his family and his relationship with his sisters, but I took a lot of that out because I don't know how Jane Austen wrote Pride and Prejudice with five sisters and made it work. I just don't. It's so hard to juggle those characters. And people were very confused by them, so I ended up taking a lot of that out and shortening that story substantially. So, but he's an interesting guy too, but his accomplishments are good for him, you know. He does manage to support himself for a while anyway, but they're nothing at all as expansive as what Coop experienced. But Coop got lucky because of where he ended up. So
I don't know why you keep reminding me of old movies, but you are. Do you remember Lifeguard? I think it was 1976. It had Sam Elliott in it.
Oh, God. I don't think I ever saw that movie, but yes, I remember it like, oh, my God, having such a huge crush on Sam Elliott.
As I recall, it wasn't a very good movie, but the reason why you made me think about it is Sam Elliott wakes up one day and realizes he's kind of this middle-aged guy who's still a lifeguard. And, you know, you can't be a lifeguard when you're 70, so what are you going to do with your life? And what you're talking about, like some of the, I don't want to say circuit guys, but some of the gay guys that are partiers and have a great time, large number of them do that for a few years and they go out, you know, get their fun out and go on with their life. But the ones that stay that way, like you said, it's like one day they realize, like, you know, I'm driving an ice cream truck.
And, right, right. You know, yeah.
It's sad to see that happen.
Yeah. Well, yeah, and it was sad that Sam Elliott said that thing about the power of the dog. I really was disappointed. I was like, are you kidding? Did you hear about that? He was complaining about that movie?
No.
He said it was like too gay or something like that. And it was like, Sam Elliott, come on. Like all of these gay boys who were your, you know, who were madly in love with you in the 70s. He did apologize for it later, but I was still disappointed in him.
I think actors have gotten much smarter. Ryan Reynolds, who I have no doubt he's straight, but I could be wrong. He knows how to play that up. And he plays it up big time.
Yeah.
And I don't think in the 70s they were as likely to do that.
Well, no, they weren't. But he didn't say this in the 70s. He said this like last, you know, in the last few months. So it was like, yeah, I mean, he probably wouldn't have really been aware of it in the 70s. But he should be aware of it by now, for God's sake.
So maybe older mentality.
Maybe, because he was super hot.
Oh, yes, he was. Yes, he was. And I'm going to totally throw us off the rails here because I love to tell my Ryan Reynolds story.
Okay.
My husband, Maurice, and I were driving through Santa Monica, and we stopped at a stop sign. And going across the crosswalk was Ryan Reynolds. And, of course, we flipped out. And I, having lived in L.A. this long, it's very rare that a celebrity, I'll even bat an eye. Uh-huh. But Ryan's a different story. I've been wanting to get into his pants for years, so to be quite honest. But he had this little fluffy dog he was walking. And we looked at each other and we were like, oh my God, he's gay. Right? He's gay. Sadly, it wasn't a few months later that I saw him and Alanis Morissette, back when they were together, playing with a dog. And it was Alanis's dog. But for a few months, I got to believe that, not that every straight man that has a fluffy dog, and not that every man that has a fluffy dog is gay,
right.
But my mind went to exactly where I wanted it to go.
Of course.
So for those few months, my fantasy was thoroughly enjoyed. But anyway.
I have to look Ryan Reynolds up. I don't know who he is, to be quite honest.
You don't know who Ryan Reynolds is?
Well, I know the name, but I just, yeah. I'm not really up on celebrity culture, to be quite honest. I mean, I don't mean that in any kind of snobby way. I just, I'm busy.
I will only tell you this. There are a lot of incredibly attractive men in this world.
Uh-huh.
Ryan is not only attractive, he is hysterically funny and damn charming.
Okay,
so the three together, I don't know how anybody could not love him.
Okay,
so
awesome. Then I love him.
Yeah, he's worth looking up. You know, if okay. he was an asshole, it'd be a whole different thing. I'd say there's a hot-looking asshole, but no, he's the total package, in my opinion.
Okay, good.
So Darcy has I don't know about love interest, but he longs for Jake Tester.
Right, right.
Who is Jake? And tell us about that little entanglement there.
Well, Jake is his grandmother's gardener who keeps this gigantic lawn. Her grandmother grows up and lives her whole life, it turns out, in the house that Coop built. But Jake is the gardener. Darcy has the hots for him. The first time they saw each other, Darcy thought, oh my God, we had this connection. But then, like, Jake was suddenly gone and Darcy was just visiting. So he went back to San Francisco. But so he's kind of been standoffish with Jake for a while. He's still the gardener and he's still taking care of his grandmother's lawn, even though she's just died. So then he decides, because he's having this moment of like, I'm going to go out and find who is trying to take away our inheritance. And he's just feeling this moment of determination and he makes a pass at Jake and then Jake accepts it. So that's who the Jake character is. But there's some complications there. And it is through Coop's story that Darcy eventually learns to maybe open up with Jake and maybe try to make something of this. So it has a hopeful ending.
Please tell me that Coop doesn't come back from the dead and tries to get in the way.
He does not. No.
Okay, good. We're not talking about paranormal. And I have no problem with paranormal.
Right.
Yeah. It just doesn't sound paranormal.
Yeah. No.
I kind of knew the answer to that one before. You did one interesting thing, and it's not a huge part of the story, but there has been major, major debate in writers' groups and even in readers' groups, and that concerns COVID.
Uh-huh.
Writers are telling me, and I think most writers are telling me they're going to ignore it, at least for now, because they don't think people want to hear it. Maybe down the road they will. And they're either skipping the years over COVID or they're just writing it like it doesn't exist. Readers are kind of conflicted as well. They think, well, it's part of history. It should be there. And I had, actually, now I've had two separate readers say, we don't want to see COVID in your book. In fact, one, I don't know where she got the idea. She said, I'm sorry, Brad, I love your books. I will not be able to read the next one because you said COVID's going to be in there. And I'm like, I don't know when the hell I ever said that, but no, I don't. It probably won't be. But you made the choice to put it in there.
Mm-hmm.
Why?
Well, because of the timing. So his grandmother was Grandma Millie, who just died, was getting pretty old. So I really couldn't push it too much into the future. And it was also a good plot element because it's Darcy's parents died of COVID, the first summer of COVID. And it just kind of worked out. But that's the extent of COVID's. Well, also, Darcy loses his job in San Francisco because of COVID, and he has to move back. But he was going to move back anyway to help his grandma. But so it's an element in there. I can understand people being sick of it at this point. But there's going to be a lot of stories about these past 2 years coming out. It may take a few years before somebody writes the right one. But yeah.
Somebody suggested to me, I can't remember who it was. He wasn't a writer. He said, I think a good idea for you, actually, it was a different podcast that I was on, but it had nothing to do with writing. It was personal stuff. And he said, I think you should write a story about COVID now while it's fresh in your head, but don't release it for 10 years.
Oh, interesting.
I said, that's a good idea.
Yeah.
Because then, you know, 10 years, we might be ready to read it. And now it's fresh in my head. But I don't know. I don't know if I'm in the mood to write about it.
Yeah, I think we're all just ready to move on, right?
Yes.
Like, really ready to move on.
Yes, absolutely. Now, the last time you were on, we talked about you working in production for PBS.
Uh-huh.
And I asked you about writing, and you said there wasn't really a transition from writing to television, because you kind of always knew you wanted to be a writer. Knowing that you wanted to be a writer, why did you choose to major in political science in college, which seems like it would be more of what would have drawn you to television?
Well, so when I was 20 years old, I was very persistent about getting...
So that was 5 years ago.
Yeah. Add a few decades to that. But I was very persistent. I interviewed for this job at the local NBC affiliate in Cleveland, WKYC. And at the time, it was the O&O. So it was owned directly by NBC. But I spent every week I called and asked for an update on if they, you know, were going to have a position for me. And after a year, they finally hired me. And I was already, I was a sophomore at least in college. And at that point, like the college was not a career path for me anymore because I was on my career path at work. So I thought I'll just study anything I'm interested in. So that's why it took me an extra year to finish because I changed majors a number of times and I was very, very interested in politics back then and super interested in Middle Eastern politics. And so that's what I studied. And it was just because I had the luxury of studying something I was interested in.
So you've ended up in public television and public radio.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that you enjoy that more than you would in commercial?
Oh,
media?
No question.
And why? And why is that?
No question about it. Because the in commercial television, I was working in news, right? So it's not like I was working for entertainment. I was working for NBC News. And I don't know if I should say the name of the network, but I already
have.
Go ahead. But the commitment there was to the ratings. It was just all about ratings. And like serving the audience with information, with interesting shows, with things that to engage them, intellectually treating them with respect. Those things didn't exist, at least what I saw. They weren't there. And when I went to PBS and NPR, this was several years after I left NBC, I had sort of a foray back into television when I moved to San Francisco. I was a print reporter. Thank God I got out of that. I'd be homeless by now. But then I was doing marketing. But, you know, as soon as I walked into those doors at KQED, it was all about like what is interesting and informative for our audience. It was all about serving the audience. I mean, not all the time, but most of the time, that was what was driving us. It still is. And that, I love that environment. I really hated the way in commercial TV, the audience was, people were contemptuous of the audience. I thought, why are you so contemptuous of these people? Like, why do you call them these names? They're our audience, for God's sake. And that atmosphere does not exist at PBS and NPR, at least it doesn't that I've seen.
Well, I don't know what time period it was that you got involved in public television, but I remember back when networks had a news division and an entertainment division.
Right.
And I can't remember what network... I'm going to say NBC, but I don't know for a fact. I probably shouldn't even have mentioned their name. I remember one of the networks was the first to announce, as a cost-saving measure, we're going to combine the two divisions together. And that is really when I think we saw things spiral downward.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's no such thing as unbiased news, because just deciding what shows are newsworthy or what stories are newsworthy, there's a bias in there. But you certainly can do the best you can.
Right.
And I think back then they used to, and that's not true anymore.
No, it isn't.
Not in any kind of shape or form. So it is sad to have seen that happen, especially nowadays. I mean, nobody's learning anything. If you If you're liberal, you watch Rachel Maddow, and that's who all you watch. And if you're conservative and even crazy conservative, you watch Tucker Carlson, and that's you're only listening to what you want to hear. And I don't think that's healthy.
No, there's a lot that's not healthy going on right now. I mean, I disagree with you just a little bit there. I think that people, if you're conservative, you only listen to conservative news. I think that people were conditioned to listen to what they want to hear. I don't think that it's they gravitated towards anything. I think they were conditioned for what they wanted. And I mean, I don't know. I'm not explaining this well. I haven't thought it through very carefully, but I think that it doesn't mean because you watch Tucker Carlson that you're like down the line a Republican and you all support Republicans and you support Trump and all. It doesn't mean that. Like there's still a lot. It's even like QAnon and all these crazy conspiracy theories that are going on today. I think we make a mistake when we write those people off because a lot of those people aren't even particularly political. It seems kind of crazy, but that's the truth. They're just not. And I'm not saying that the leaders aren't, but I'm saying that the people who are involved and then wrapped up in these things, they're not as political maybe as we think they are. I think they just, it's just kind of a group dynamics, tribal politics, you know? And I think that they are still very reachable. Not that I have the insight and knowledge to reach them, yeah. But they are. And I think we should be trying to, so.
And actually, Darma Kelleher and I talked about that last week, that regardless of what kind of, let's say, the leaders of particular parties are, people, the general public are just connecting with people that feel the way they do.
Right.
And it's not particularly news. There's just like comfort. There's that comfort level of, you know, you're, regardless of what side of the aisle you're on, I'm not going to go there, but we're more comfortable with people that think like us. And I think people tend on both sides of the aisle tend to be thinking a lot more radical, for lack of a better word. I hate to use that word, but
extremist, and I think that's what, I think.
Yeah, extremist. And I think that's what it comes down to. I don't think there's huge, I'm not big on conspiracy theories because people talk. But let's say there's some minor ones going on. Overall, it's just people taking advantage of what they're seeing. And they're telling people what they want to hear.
Yeah.
So,
yeah,
that could be, that's a whole different story.
It is a whole different topic, but an interesting one, but it's a whole different topic.
So you were with public television back in 1994 when Tales of the City came out.
I think it was just after Tales of the City. I think Tales came out in 93.
Okay.
Yeah.
And when did you start?
94.
Okay, so you definitely felt the impact.
Yes.
Because they were in serious trouble after that happened.
Well,
conservatives were ready to yank out every penny.
Yeah. Well, you know, the thing is for KQED, the money that people pay for taxes that come to KQED is, in fact, that come to CPB or NPR is tiny. It's very small. And KQED had never gets more than like 10% of our money from those sources. So it was like, it wasn't as scary for us, but there were a lot of little stations that it was a big threat to them to have federal funding pulled. But thankfully it wasn't. But there was a lot of controversy. There was, you know, Marlon Riggs, The Tongues Untied, that documentary about African-American gay men. That got a lot of criticism. It was a beautiful doc, you know, and Tales of the City really wasn't that risque as far as I was concerned. It was great, but I think it may have been the first, like, romantic same-sex, like, real same-sex kiss on TV that came out of Tales. But it wasn't like, you know, graphic sex or anything like that, but...
Okay, but it was more than a kiss. We saw men naked in bathhouses. We saw people openly doing drugs and not done in a negative way. They just did drugs. And
right.
I'm going to disagree with you. I think it was a big step.
Well, and I don't remember naked men in bathhouses in Tales of the City. I mean, not the original one. It may have been, Brad. I'm not saying that you're wrong. I don't remember that. I remember that kiss. And I remember... Because this was, people were still making appointment TV. Everyone was watching the same episode at the same time. I remember getting calls from straight friends saying, like, oh my God, there was a gay kiss on TV. So, but I don't remember all the rest of that. But you could be right. I don't remember.
Yeah, I watched it not too long ago, and I'm almost certain there was some nudity because the guy that played Rocketeer, that Disney, both my husband and I had crushes on him long ago, and I kept waiting for him to be naked. It never happened. Very disappointing. But I think we were anticipating that because there was other nudity shown in the story. But anyway,
okay.
It still was way beyond its years.
Yes, it was.
And what I found interesting with that is, you and I have discussed this before, that I remember growing up, PBS was opera, symphonies, and the whole reason that I recall saying there was public support for public media was to protect these classics that were going away. And you'd be hard pressed to find an opera on PBS these days. It's changed dramatically. We have Tales of the City, and I actually, Saturday Night Live did a really funny skit years ago, and it was probably one of the biggest routines I remember them doing. And I have not been able to find it anywhere online. They had flashing neon lights. They had people singing and dancing, and it was supposedly a PBS commercial about we're not stuffy anymore. And what made it brilliant was the next week, the president of PBS came on and assured the public they are stuffy and always will be stuffy, which made it even more funny.
Yeah.
But do you ever see it going back to what I recall is perfect? What I hear on as far as NPR, public radio, is almost entirely news.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. I mean, KQED is an all-news station. And do I see it going back to, like, are we talking about NPR or PBS here?
Really kind of both, but let's go with NPR.
Well, NPR started as a news service that stations like KQED would just sort of feed out to their public using this, you know, the local signals. But, you know, we do a lot of local news and information programming on KQED public radio. I can't see that ever changing. It used to be that KQED ran on the radio like a lot of bluegrass and a lot of, you know, like you said, opera, different classical music. But I cannot see us going back to that. We've become too important as a news source just because so we've lost so many reliable news sources in the last 20 years. And people rely on KQED in Northern California because there's no other real source of that kind of intense focus on local news and information. So I don't think for KQED, there's no going back.
Yeah. I will tell you this, in the podcasting world, all the different groups and that sort of thing, when you talk about podcasting, and you talk about the cream of the crop, NPR is always up there.
Good.
It's always the cream of the crop. Now, I will argue that whether or not they're actually podcasts, because they are shows that end up being podcasting-like, but they're still, you can't deny that. Beautifully done. Beautifully done.
I understand what you mean about just turning shows into a streaming audio file, and that makes it a podcast. I understand what you're saying there, but we also, KQED produces a number of very interesting podcasts that never air. So we do have a podcast inventory that is not just taken from our on-air shows, but a lot are, yes.
Yes, I agree with you. There are. I will say, wait, don't tell me. I love it every week.
I do too.
But then they put it on as a podcast, and it is not a podcast. But that's a whole different – I'm glad they do because I rarely can listen to it when it's on anyway. But
right.
That's a whole different story. So the name of the book is Inherit the Lightning.
Yes, Inherit
and
the Lightning.
It is out now. Buy it.
Yeah, get it at Bold Strokes Books. You can go there if you don't want to go to the, you know, feed the gigantic octopus. But it is available every other place, so as of today.
Yeah, we know the big guy has them, but go to Bold Strokes Books.
Yeah, they would love to have you online. And if, you know, like there's a lot of writers at Bold Strokes who are very interesting, mostly LGBT, and you know, you can find a lot of interesting stuff there. So,
and it is not an exaggeration that we would not see a lot of these outstanding authors if it wasn't for some of these small town presses.
That's right. That's so true.
So support the hell out of them.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Well, thank you, Bud. It was great to have you on again. I appreciate
it. Yeah. Thank you, Brad. It was a lot of fun to see you again. And yeah, good luck with everything. And congratulations on being named by BuzzFeed as one of the top. You're going to have to say that.
Well, it was one of the top queer podcasts as you go about your queer day. I don't know if I have that correct, but it's pretty close.
But it's like one of the top, it's like the top 20 podcasts. So it's like you're really high up there.
Yes, yes. I do want to do a shout out to my friends over at the Big Gay Fiction Podcast. They made the list, but...
Yes, they did.
Good for you guys, but I don't really care. No, Jeff and Will have been great to me from day one when I started, but awesome. It was quite an honor to be included on the list with them.
Yes, yeah, absolutely.
So thank you for mentioning it.
Yeah, you bet. So, thanks for having me again, Brad.